The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister and Guy Jafrady.
Hello, a warm welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. We are already almost at the 100th episode. Tomorrow we will record the 93rd episode. Today, however, we are still celebrating a premiere. We are recording our first live podcast today. A founder interview with Sebastian Betchen, the founder of Alma Technologies and today CEO of RealWear. We could hardly have chosen a better place for this than here at the BEA Expo in Bern, one of the largest and most traditional events in Switzerland. At this point, a big thank you to the SME Impulse Program Berner Kantonalbank and all organizers for making this possible. Of course, also a thank you to all guests listening today and to our Burn Rate sponsors, RA Ventures, Omnium, Wenger Welly, and the Upscaler Program. My name is Guy Jafrady, and I am co-host of Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast, co-founder and general partner of Koyo Capital, a Swiss VC fund, and co-founder and board member of RA Ventures, the Bernese Business Angel Club. Before we jump into the conversation with Sebastian Betchen, I would like to briefly give you some context about what we actually do at Burn Rate. Together with my partner, Max Meister, also from Bern, I talk every week about what is happening in the venture capital and startup ecosystem. We look at the most important financing rounds, transactions, trends, and developments, and try to classify them, not only what is happening, but above all, why it is happening and what the impact actually is on Switzerland and on our ecosystem. Our goal is to bring more transparency into the startup ecosystem because much of what happens in our venture world is often difficult to grasp from the outside. At the same time, the startup ecosystem has become an important part of Switzerland's economic landscape, with many innovative companies like Alma Technologies or RealWear, a lot of talent, and now also very many jobs that are created annually. In addition to the podcast, Max and I mentioned it, are active as investors. We focus on deep tech companies, so everything based on real technological breakthroughs, areas like AI, robotics, climate tech, and other future relevant topics. We have been active in the ecosystem for over 10 years, that is in the startup ecosystem, and have initiated and driven many initiatives forward. For everyone interested, you can of course find Burn Rate on Spotify and Apple Podcast and everywhere else where you normally listen to your podcasts. We also publish a weekly newsletter and very regularly content on LinkedIn. But enough about us. Let's get to the most important part of today. Today we have Sebastian Betchen here on stage. Sebastian is a Bernese startup founder. He founded Alma Technologies in 2021, a high-tech company that develops and sells or has sold augmented reality glasses, AR glasses, for industrial applications. At the beginning of 2025, Alma was sold to RealWear after the successful launch of the technology, that is its first glasses. A global leader in the field of augmented reality in the industrial sector and also in wearable technologies. Particularly nice from a Bern perspective, Alma started at Marktgasse 46. That's where they operated from. Sebastian and his team were then integrated into RealWear, and this corporation, which Sebastian now leads as CEO, is managed from Marktgasse 46. Today, we want to get to know Sebastian better in a personal conversation. We talk about what Alma or RealWear actually builds and why this technology is relevant. We look at the development of Alma, the challenges of building a hardware-software startup in a new market, and then, of course, we discuss the acquisition by RealWear and what it takes mentally to build and lead a globally relevant technology company from Bern. We talk about what shaped Sebastian, his affinity for technology. We will start with that right away, and what really drove him to found a company. Welcome to Burn Rate, Sebastian. I'm extremely happy that you are here.
Hey, Guy. Thanks for the invitation.
Let's start very fundamentally. What exactly does Alma Technologies, or today RealWear, actually do? Maybe so you can explain it to the audience that doesn't use AR glasses every day or isn't very familiar with technology. How would you explain it concretely?
So RealWear develops AR glasses for industry, meaning for frontline workers. I even brought something here. And what it does is basically that machines are produced in Switzerland or Germany, which are becoming increasingly complex, and then shipped all over the world and used there. If there is a problem there, then only the experts from Switzerland or Germany can really help. Previously, they had to fly there, and with our glasses, the workers who only operate the machine can now put on the glasses, and through the sensors, the expert from Switzerland or Germany sees exactly what I, as the worker, see and can help me step by step to solve the problems I have.
Yes, that is extremely exciting. That, of course, massively reduces flights, so you could almost say you are a climate tech startup as well. Maybe you can give a short example of a case that one of your customers has recently or even some time ago solved through Almer.
We have local customers such as Gilgen Logistics. They produce here in Bern, Canton Bern, and then deliver their logistics centers, for example, to German customers. They partly do remote assistance on construction sites. But we also have customers like Löpfe, who bring this to India or Bangladesh and then support inspections from Switzerland.
Very exciting. So global customers, you mentioned a few Swiss customers earlier. Where is your main customer base located today?
In Europe and America.
And maybe again, why is this technology so relevant today? What has changed in recent years so that video assistance with augmented reality glasses is even used today and that a market is developing for it?
Yes. So I think on the one hand, the problems were always there, but it has now become possible also due to better internet connections. Through COVID, it also became clear that video telephony became normal. That became possible, and now with AI, it is accelerating again because our glasses are like the first devices that see exactly what a human sees and can really be enhanced.
Yes, extremely exciting. That helps us classify a bit better what it is about technologically and also practically. Now let's take a big step back to Sebastian's background. You are from Bern. You told me you grew up in rural Kirchlindach, went to high school in Bern, and later studied engineering at EPFL. After that, you were in Delft at ETH, and then also in China at, I have to read this, Tsinghua University. Let's start from the beginning. What shaped you in your childhood and youth so that you later took the step into entrepreneurship?
Yes, good question. I think I already had a bit of a spirit of discovery and invention in me. I think those were important influences or simply characteristics I had from the beginning. My family, part of my family were also entrepreneurs. I think you get a bit used to that. Yes, I think those are two main points.
So entrepreneurship and affinity for technology. How did that manifest your interest in technology in childhood or youth?
On the one hand, I had focus bursts as a child, especially when playing with Lego. When I got a new Lego Technic set, I would only do that for 2 days until it was finished, not even eat. My mother was sometimes a bit worried that I didn't eat or sleep for 2 days until it was done, and then everything was normal again, but I think that was definitely something. And then over time, yes, growing up with agricultural machines, I also briefly passed by them here at BEA, and then later computers, taking computers apart, putting them back together, improving them, and that developed quite naturally.
You said something interesting in preparation, that agricultural machines as a tool for humans to even perform a task really shaped you. What was an image that stayed in your mind?
Yes. So agricultural machines simply amplify human strength, muscle power. And I think today it's unthinkable without agricultural machines. And I think in the future, it will be unthinkable to have our mental power without machines because they massively amplify our mental power and much more will come. So I think that was one thing that really touched me. The other thing is also seeing that Switzerland was relatively poor not so long ago. My ancestors came from Lenk in Simmental and some of them had to emigrate to America because they didn't have enough to eat. They went by sailing ship and then migrated across America to chop wood on the West Coast for the gold miners. And when they had earned enough money, they migrated back, returned by sailing ship and went back to Lenk, but then had enough money. And I think today we sometimes forget that so many of our ancestors worked extremely hard so that we can now complain about, I don't know, a cold cheeseburger. And I think there is also a part of me that wants to make a contribution to society so that we move forward.
Yes, Silicon Valley impact, that's exciting. We will come back to that later. And maybe briefly on your path, you studied at ETH and Tsinghua University, two of the best places for computer vision, a topic where you are now an industry expert. But maybe a bit on the dynamics. You mentioned Switzerland earlier was relatively poor, then wealth was built through hard work. It's similar with China today. If you look at the dynamics at both universities and maybe also in the markets, how did you experience that and what stands out?
So I was first at EPFL, ETH Lausanne, and that was much better because it is younger and less known and therefore still a bit more dynamic. Whereas I find ETH is too aware of its reputation and praises itself too much and is not dynamic enough. In China, for example, the whole attitude is very different and people are much more ambitious and say they still have to catch up massively. There is much higher pressure in a positive sense and much more energy. And I strongly miss that in Switzerland.
So you basically brought the energy back to Switzerland. Can one say that?
I hope so. I can't bring a billion people, but yes, I hope a little bit.
Yes, we won't go into politics now. Then you decided to found Almer together with your co-founder, Timon. How did the idea for Almer actually emerge? This optics topic, you explained to me a few years ago that at that time, augmented reality in industrial environments was still at the very beginning and basically non-existent. How did you start? What was the trigger? And how did you decide?
Yes, I think the main reason was that I saw that HoloLens and other big companies like Apple with the Apple Vision Pro all make these huge glasses that can do many things technologically, but not really well. Not a good product that solves one thing completely well. And I just said, that won't work like that. Something will be missing, even if it's very impressive technology. It needs something that is truly a good product and much more focused. And if they don't do it, someone has to do it. Because it's super important technology to move society forward, so we'll do it. And it wasn't necessarily the goal to found a company, but rather a base platform that others could build on. ETH didn't want to support us because it was too applied and you couldn't write papers, so we founded a company.
Interesting. So basically founding a company out of necessity because research didn't want to research. Could you say that you then called your co-founder Timon? You knew him from EPFL?
Exactly.
How did you convince him to co-found on that basis?
I didn't want to convince him, honestly. That wasn't the plan. I just knew Timon from EPFL, and I knew he was extremely good, and usually, very good people work with other very good people. And as the project became more real, I called Timon and said, "Hey Timon, long time no hear." It had been almost 4 years. I said, "Hey, I have this crazy project, very complex, really needs top people. I know you work with many good people. Can you recommend some?" And he said, "I have some interviews next week. I'll cancel them all. I'll come to you. I can start tomorrow." That still honors me today.
That's extremely cool when you reconnect and can tag a top team together. And I mean, when you found a startup, 1 out of 10 is successful and maybe 1 out of 100 is really successful. Were you aware of this risk and how did you deal with it?
Yes, good question. I think we just weren't aware that we were really founding a company, but more like a very aggressive and ambitious student project at the beginning. We said, okay, we put our savings into it and we started in March and had money until August and just said, hey, it's worth pushing forward until August and then we'll see. I think we never worried about ourselves or anything. Just, okay, we tried to make a contribution and went full speed. That way you never have fear. It just lasted longer. Others found what we did cool and helpful, then we had more money and another 6 months. Then we thought, okay, 6 more months, cool, full speed again. And so it continued until we suddenly became quite big.
Yes, extremely exciting. So no risk, no fun, and all in mentality, one could summarize it a little like that. What did you focus on in this initial phase? It is extremely complex. It is hardware, it is software, of course, almost a roadmap to the product. And what did that look like?
Yes. So originally, the dream was always really also glasses. We just then asked ourselves, okay, what does it really need? And in parallel to the main development, technology development, we actually also did customer research and experimented with customers and pretty quickly got in touch with industrial companies. And for that, we then basically developed a prototype that was actually nothing more than a helmet and a smartphone glued on top. Or a Raspberry Pi, depending, and it was remotely controlled by Timon, and that worked very well. With it, we could very quickly adjust what it really needs, what the field of view, meaning the size of the display, has to be, what it should show, what not. And we did that until the customers actually wanted to buy this prototype. Of course, they couldn't, because Timon is not for sale. But that way, we were able to find out very quickly, okay, what does it really need? What is not so important? And one thing we learned, for example, is that many large companies like Microsoft or Apple primarily optimized for the largest possible field of view, meaning the largest possible display. That sounds very cool, But for industrial customers, it doesn't bring that much. They actually want something smaller, but with very good quality. We noticed that, and we did that too, and it was very appreciated.
So you really focused on the customer and defined the technology or the requirements, the demands on the technology together with them, and then you went into product development of the hardware and also the software, right?
Yes. So it was never that strongly cut off. It is always an interplay. Every now and then you have phases where you have more, okay, now we know the requirements, and then you do a bit more just product development. Sometimes you do a bit more only customers, but it is actually always a cycle and a continuous improvement. It is not once you've done it and then that's it, but we always kept developing. And the Arc One was also not really a commercial product. We thought it was, but it was more prototypes. But we learned a lot with it and did already deliver it to certain paying customers. I am very grateful to our customers who supported us a lot there and also had a lot of patience and appreciated very much how quickly we continued developing.
And maybe briefly back to the first product. We also briefly discussed it in the preliminary conversation. A helmet, it sometimes fell apart, glued together. How important was this continuous development that you did? This, hey, we have to go to the customer and develop it. Looking back now, how important was that for you to become successful at all with Alma and to win the customers?
I think that is probably one of the most important things. And if I did it again, I would do it even more. So every second you spend doing that is certainly super valuable. I think many startups are too afraid that it is not good enough. And yes, you feel ashamed down to the ground. So our first prototypes, the ones we made, we assembled them on the way there on the train to the customer. And then when we were at the entrance, everything fell apart again. And then we just put tape all around it and thought, we can't continue like this. But yes, actually you can. It is even very important. I recommend that to everyone. If you are not ashamed of it, then you are too late.
Okay, actually very American. So be the American and Israeli says, go to the customer, develop the product and...
I don't know whether that is American or Israeli or whatever, but I just think that is the right way. And you also have to be open with the customer and say, hey, this is still heavily in development. In return, you can also influence it, but it may sometimes be that it just doesn't work. So yes, it is a beta product.
And those first customers, pilot customers we call them, that you won, did they already pay for the product? And that was the status where they paid for the first projects.
So through that, we also developed a new business model where people actually don't pay for the hardware, but for the service so that they can use these products and then continuously receive updates, software updates, but also hardware. That means, yes, at the beginning, they got an Arc 1 that wasn't good yet, but then over time, they received an Arc 2 for free, which was much better. And that made many customers super happy because they said, hey, with the Arc 1, I still don't see the image sharply. That's not good enough. The camera is not so good, and the angle should be a bit more downward. Yes, that is very difficult to find out in an office. You simply have to find it out through iterating. And we did that with the Arc 2, and then they saw it and said, that's cool. It is exactly what I said. Perfect. And that made many very, very happy.
And as far as you are allowed to share it with us at all from these first pilot customers, how many are still customers today? So what does the churn rate look like?
Relatively many. That almost makes me the proudest that most of them are still there. That is super cool. And I appreciate that enormously.
And we have now covered enough on strategy, risk, mindset, the starting point. We already mentioned it, developing hardware is demanding. Software is then certainly similarly demanding again.
Software never ends.
Software never ends, exactly. And at the same time, selling the use case to the customer as a service. That is, of course, exciting if you can do it that way. That is a classic go big or go home situation. You can't simply iterate and then after 2 years realize nothing is happening. And which assumptions that you had right at the beginning in the founding phase turned out to be wrong? Where did you think, hey, we actually wanted to do it this way and that way? Maybe it's a customer group, maybe it's some kind of development plan. Where were you completely off?
I think with time, it always takes longer than you think and hope. But you always have to begin with the, I think, punchline. How hard can it be? Otherwise, you never start. If you know how long it will take and how much effort and how difficult it is, then I think nobody would start. Nobody would become a company. I find, so Jensen Huang from NVIDIA, the founder, was asked, okay, if you were 25 again, what company would you found? and he is super successful, even if he knows, okay, he is super successful. He said, oh, hell no, I would not found a company again. And it is simply, yes, a lot of energy that you have to put in, and it is always much more than you think. And therefore, I think we underestimated time the most.
As investors, we always say it takes twice as long and becomes twice as expensive. Are those metrics roughly accurate, or did it become much more expensive and take much longer?
So for software developers, when I ask a software developer, I heard this once and have done it like that ever since. If a software developer tells me, okay, I need one day, then I say 1 week. If he says, I need 1 week, then I calculate with 1 month. If he says 1 month, 1 year, it is always an order of magnitude more, actually. Then, okay, maybe.
Exactly. Okay, very good. And maybe also which assumption was surprisingly accurate and confirmed itself extremely strongly.
So focus is always good, I think. And we preached that from the beginning. Focus, simple. So for the customers, for the purchase, for production, we did that, I think, always, that we, yes, focused on simplicity. For example, other competitors of ours had said, yes, they want like the iPhone model to make as many apps as possible. And we had exactly one app that started automatically. So you switched on the device and it starts directly into the app, nothing else. And although we put much less effort into it, we had a much better experience because it needs much less. And I think that has also always paid off, that you reduce.
And now you had a very clear focus. You always told investors that you did hardware. That is notoriously rather difficult, or it was at that time in 2021, to win funding. How did you manage it? Maybe briefly for the listeners, this is a Venture Insider podcast, so all of that was financed by venture capital investors in several rounds. And how did you manage that? How difficult was fundraising at that time, especially for hardware startups?
Yes, I have no comparison, honestly. And I think if you ask a child, how did you learn to walk? I just did it. So it somehow had to work, then you do it. So from that perspective, I don't know, there is no magic bullet, or I simply have no comparison. Maybe at some point with the next or the one after next venture, I can say it. I don't know. What helped me a lot, however, I have to say, was the Swisspreneur fundraising masterclass that they did. For me, that was by far the best material and strategy for doing funding rounds anywhere on the internet. So shout out to Swisspreneur.
Very nice.
That is really super good. And I followed that pretty strictly for the first two rounds and then developed my own style a bit. That was actually very helpful, but otherwise just do it.
Very good. And you were several times at the end of the runway. So you didn't have much capital left in the account and had to think about how to still pay salaries or whether to close the doors now. How did you as founders deal with that, especially when it was no longer just the two guys, Timon and Sebastian, but a whole team that depended on the company?
Yes. So we started with Timon and me. We always had the attitude, okay, this will end at some point anyway, or precisely as a student project, so to speak. It was like, okay, we have 3 months. Ah, cool. We have 6 months. Oh, wow. We have a whole year. From that perspective, I think we were set up differently than most other startups and much more willing to take risks and just said, yes, go, go, go. And what we actually said is that what we get out of it is the learning. For example, in the first 1.5 years, I also didn't pay myself a single salary and worked on the side on weekends. And what I got out of it was more a learning. And if you have that attitude, I think you actually cannot lose, only win. Because learnings, you can't lose them anymore. You have them forever. And we always looked at it like that and also tried to teach the team that mentality, so to speak. So simply this attitude. We didn't have wild parties, but certainly very wild days and nights with us, simply because we said, hey, we are together on the journey. Enjoy the journey, even if it is hard. This is something nobody can take away from you. Whatever happens, was it worth it up to today? If yes, great. If no, okay, then we change that. And that way, nobody really has great fear of losing something.
So you can't unlearn something. That is a very important takeaway. I find that extremely exciting. Then it moved a bit out of the startup phase. You shipped the products. Arc One was on the market. Then Realware came and they wanted to acquire you. And that was already an established player. One could say David against Goliath. They had already raised over $100 million by then. So money was invested by venture capital investors. How did the first conversations with Realware actually arise and who made the first move?
Yes, that was actually our mutual partner, TeamViewer. TeamViewer was and is, yes, a global leader in remote assistance, and they worked closely with both of us, but had some difficulties working with Realware and therefore increasingly worked with us. And because of our focus, we simply focused on TeamViewer, which they appreciated very much, and that worked very well. And TeamViewer basically put us together at the table and invited both of us and said, hey, let's talk. Could you imagine working together? That was how it was, and then the conversations actually got started.
Yes, they got started. Now, Elmer was David, Realware Goliath. How did you experience these conversations? What are the things that stayed with you? And how did you have to navigate around that as, if we say, a small fish opposite this large technology company that was already in the market worldwide?
Yes. So that was certainly relatively challenging. But also, again, if you say we can, that was also a first for us. And that means we also jumped into these negotiations with a certain cheerfulness and YOLO attitude that we could actually only learn. Even if it didn't work out, then we would be better positioned for the next time. And because of that, I think we were not very afraid of losing something and negotiated pretty well, I would say, in short. What I also really appreciate is the team. We had a super, super good team that was very close and gave us backing during that time. Without that, it would not have been possible. If we had had to constantly put out fires within Almer, then it would not have worked at all. And with a super team, they gave us so much backing that Timon and I could actually focus on the negotiation.
Yes, and there, what was particularly important in the negotiations, you mentioned the team. Did you bring in external people so that everything was implemented the way you had discussed it and so that it also worked for you?
Yes, of course, we then brought in lawyers and so on externally. But no, actually, otherwise, a lot of it, you have to come with these ideas yourself, with these ideas. Yes.
Yes, and then you were acquired, so integrated into Realware, one can say. So basically, the company was bought. How did the roles then develop after the acquisition? What was your role and maybe also what was Timon's?
Yes, so Timon's role was CTO, which he still is now. I was officially COO for 3 months, and then that changed, and we were asked by the board whether we wanted to take over and whether I wanted to be CEO. Then I gladly said yes.
So for the CEO, that is a bit of understatement. You were asked whether you wanted to become CEO. What did you do in those 3 months so that you were even positioned to take on this CEO role and lead a global team?
So I think during those 3 months, not that much, honestly. I think it was more the time before. During the negotiations, we met the most important shareholders of Realware in person, got to know them, sensed them, gathered their opinions, went through business plans with them, contributed our proposals. On the one hand, that. On the other hand, I think having a smaller startup is the best business school there is, and that certainly prepared me very well for it. It wasn't that much different. Of course, we had to learn quite a lot quickly, but it was... yes, simply a bit more complex, a bit bigger, not completely new.
Not completely new. Culture, Silicon Valley versus Swiss startup. How does that differ? You said your team was great, always kept your back free. And when we look from Switzerland to Silicon Valley, everyone is always, wow, thinking it is a huge, huge thing. Everything extremely professional, everyone fully pushing 24/7 mentality. How did you experience that live in your skin?
Yes, I think Realware was not a typical Silicon Valley company. On average, they were already a bit older in terms of workforce. And I think we at Almer were more the Silicon Valley company than they were, simply because we were younger, more aggressive, and had more of a let's do it attitude compared to Realware. What is certainly different is a bit more of a mentality of spending money. I think that also became a problem at Realware before. It works up to a certain point. It needs a good balance sometimes. But fundamentally, the way I perceive Silicon Valley, it is simply saying, yes, more and more, let's do it. So I am there from time to time, and it is simply what I miss in Switzerland. Just this, yes, let's go and let's do it. And then the worst that can happen is, ah, no, it doesn't work. Ah, not so tragic.
Yes, that is something we often discuss in the podcast as well. You just have to do it. And the worst is a no, or that it just doesn't work. And you mentioned culture. What did you have to do so that the culture is, you were 70 employees at the time when you took over the CEO position. What did you have to do so that the...
A bit more, yes.
Or even a bit more. So that it worked like glue again and everyone pulled in the same direction.
Yes, that was... Very good question. That was probably the hardest thing of all. I think what was probably most important there was getting out the demotivated people, the people with ultra high salary demands, and the people who had gotten used to being able to talk behind someone's back and who were negative all the time. And we did that very quickly in the first 36 hours, most of it. That yes, and then simply creating a culture where you have high transparency. That means, for example, we now have an all hands every Monday, 15 to 20 minutes, but every team says briefly what they did last week, where they have problems, what they will do this week, and a short meme for laughing. And that gives, in a very short time, a lot of, yes, understanding for everyone what the others are doing. And okay, yes, I think transparency and short communication paths are super important, and that you also build trust there in all other employees.
And how do you do that concretely? So you had wild parties you mentioned earlier in Switzerland, very likely in Bern at Marktgasse. Now you are with the team in Silicon Valley in America, one in Bern, and then you still have employees globally. How do you manage in a small company like this to maintain this cohesion so that everyone says, hey, I am an employee of Realware. I want to stay there. I'm not just going to the next job just because I earn $5,000 more per year there.
Yes. So that is certainly much more difficult with a team that is distributed. Again, I think these, we call them Realware syncs, are certainly very important. Exactly. That there are these all hands where everyone knows what the others are doing, what they are battling with. That is very important. And then, difficult to say, simply also having joy and not taking the whole thing too formally. I think that is important. We also sometimes have in-person meetings where we fly people in and then hold meetings there, and we often do them very unconventionally. So those are more frat house style meetings where we all live together for a week, cook together from A to Z sometimes even. Not in a sexual sense, but share beds simply because yes, and then just work full speed, but also then go to the beach or whatever. Yes, that bonds people.
Basically a real experience together as a team. When you climb to the summit together, you connect more than just, hey, we have a meeting and ciao, go spend the evening yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, and maybe Realware today. A few more points where we could go into, where are you today? Customers, market leadership, maybe number of live devices. I don't know what you can share and want to tell, but that would certainly be exciting to hear.
Yes, so we currently have around 80,000 devices in circulation. Yes, the largest part is in Europe and America. And what we are now, what Timon and I are very interested in is actually the next steps from hardware to more and more software platform, because we have invested a lot in the operating system to make it really very simple to use, because it is a new compute paradigm. And there you have to rethink. It is not apps like smartphones. That is new. And you really have to think very carefully about how that works. And we have really invested a lot so that it is really a voice-first operating system. And now many others are slowly also realizing a bit, especially with AI, oh, okay, voice is still cool. And now not only our competitors are actually coming to us and want to license the operating system, and then it really is actually a platform, but even chip manufacturers, so Qualcomm and Nvidia, have also heard that. And they are very actively in conversation with us. And that is, of course, fun. And that, yes, we can keep learning a lot. And it is very interesting. So the chip manufacturers are very slow from that perspective. Yes, for us, years feel like days for them. But yes, in that sense, I think, yes, we are very actively working on that.
And now voice control in Bernese German, can it do that?
Yes, that works too. It is surprising. I find it surprising. It was always, always. So many friends said, yes, yes, that is our secret language, Bernese German. Not even machines understand that. Yes, well, actually it does.
Yes, very good. The next question would also have gone into the topic of AI, but not exactly on the topic that you might now become an AI device in terms of input. Everyone is talking about AI. AI companies are fully in the boom, in the hype. Augmented reality was still extremely relevant in 2021 with COVID. With the metaverse, of course, but we are no longer in the same hype cycle. What role does AI play in your product development?
So I think we have integrated AI, or simply, especially now, for example, Claude, everywhere, and not only in product development for Claude Code, for example, that is clear, but we also have it in sales and in operations and actually everywhere.
So you fully leverage the universe of AI, what one can do today, so that you are an efficient company. Can one say that?
Yes, fully. I think whoever does not do that is like still being out there with paper. Okay? Have fun.
Exactly. One can say that. We also use AI and all those tools a lot. That is what makes 3 out of 1 today. And now maybe briefly, you have customers in the USA, in Asia, and in Switzerland, also in Europe, Germany, you mentioned once. How do these 3 locations differ from a customer perspective and from a dynamics perspective through your glasses?
Yes. So I think most people in Europe underestimate, and the Swiss, I feel, compare themselves with Europe. And that is extremely bad, because I think most people are not aware that Europe at the moment is drifting toward Africa in terms of development level. So really, neither Asia nor America really perceives Europe anymore. Not even by now, not even as a sales market, because it is becoming too tedious. And we also see that with our customers. European customers are ultra tedious, ultra slow, and then less and less relevant. And in, for example, America, it is often simply more competent, often faster, and then real money behind it, so that you can really make a real project out of it. Not and precisely the whole thing faster and more serious. So that is something I find very, it scares me as a Swiss person, honestly.
Yes, good. We have to keep our eyes open a bit there. And what would have to happen now if it scares you? There is always an idea one has to improve things again. You also mentioned at the beginning, hey, we are Swiss. Our origin is not on the big resources, oil or gold. We don't have that. What would have to happen so that Switzerland and maybe also Europe become more competitive again, especially in deep tech in the hardware sector, and can build globally scaling technology companies?
Yes. So I think we are already at a point where it becomes very difficult to catch up again. Honestly, I think it would need something similar to late industrialization. Switzerland literally missed the connection for the train systems and railway expansion. It was totally behind, and there was the fear that Germany and France and Italy would actually bypass Switzerland, so to speak. And as a response, the Gotthard Tunnel was built, and that was actually a collaboration between industrial entrepreneurs and politics and society all together. That was quite a feat of strength. So it does not happen by itself. It was quite a feat of strength. What that actually achieved was the foundation of today's Switzerland and also of today's prosperity. And I think it would now need a similar feat of strength and collaboration between actually industry and, yes, politics and society as a whole. But if society does not want that and compares itself with Europe, yes, good luck. The problem today is, if you look at Europe, I find Europe even worse than Switzerland, because simply with regulations and so on, so much is killed off before you even start that you have almost no chance.
I just see the water that we have here on the table. It does not have this attached cap closure. I actually don't find that so bad. But back to the topic, slowly toward the end of the podcast, let's reflect briefly again on the personal level. I mean, maybe if you look back on the now 5 years of Alma, now Realware, what were the most beautiful moments and what were the hardest moments for you as a founder?
I think those were almost always the same moments, honestly. The most beautiful and the hardest were often similar. For me, the most beautiful were often especially at the beginning, we had several times, sometimes almost weekly, situations where it was, if we don't get this done, then the whole company is done and everyone can go home. Then it became so clear that everyone really worked together simply to solve it. And then it was again, okay, we solved it. And then a week later, something like that came again. And that was simply very intense working together. And then sometimes, then we solved it. Then many went out somewhere because they were so relieved. And then came back, slept on the floor in the office all together. And then the next morning directly into the daily. And those were very intense moments, but also very beautiful ones. I think the team will never forget them for their lives.
Exciting. And as a final question, what would you pass on to young entrepreneurs, founders who now want to build a technologically very demanding company as you did in today's time?
Just do it. Simply start, yes, and don't wait, but simply do it.
So go out with the product before it is perfect.
Yes. Or also simply found a company before you have thought about it 10 times. Simply do it and you will learn. I think that is the most important thing.
Sebastian, heartfelt thanks for your openness for this conversation. I am very happy that you are here today at Burnrate at the BEA Live. And of course, also a big thank you to the audience the large audience here at the BEA and the SME Impulse program again, that you really made this event possible. For everyone who was here, you can scan the QR code and listen to more Burn Rate episodes. Burn Rate is available as usual on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We are happy if you listen in and give us feedback. Thank you very much. And until next time, at Burn Rate.